They built two houses in Lincoln. First one, the more glorious one that they live in now. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's see. Do you have anything else?
Yes. Just let me ask about the going back to your parents initially. The religion. Were your parents?
My father was an agnostic. My mother was religious. And I went to Sunday school, and it never did take on me. I was an agnostic too, until, not really an agnostic. I mean, I was more like a Unitarian, I suppose.
Joseph Priestley.
Yeah. And I would pray when I felt I needed to or something like that, but I really didn't feel like I had any connection with God. And that changed, and after I got married, my family was married into was more religious, and somehow before about 1983, I became a believer, and my family, Randy too was a believer, became a believer, and at first I was interested in the Catholic Church, although that was a thing. Church of either of my families, and this family, my new family, is Episcopal, which beliefs and liturgy is about the same as the Catholic Church, except for these big bumps like the marriage of priests and the involvement of the church in reproduction and women's place in the world, stuff like that. But they, about the rest of it is pretty much the same, which is considering how the church developed. It's not a Protestant church, it's a national church. Henry VIII started because he wanted his own personal church because of his personal problems. And he proclaimed that he was the head of the church as far as England was concerned. There was no intent, really, difference in belief except for who ran the show. And that's why the churches are still that much the same. And John Paul became Pope, and although I was likely to stand on communism, I didn't like the church's increased meddling in reproductive and sexual affairs of people, and I didn't like what I felt was the their working towards a decrease instead of an increase in the status of women in society. And I just kept working on this, and I went to the baptism to my grandchildren with my wife, from the priest that was a friend of hers in Falls City, and Episcopal priest, of course, and many witnesses and baptisms of Godfather, and just something I never experienced before. I was just a warm glow of religious certainty kind of unfolded me, and I asked the priest to baptize me too, and they didn't take anything that lightly, so I had to talk to him for about an hour to explain what had happened, what he was talking to do. And he baptized me, and so I was baptized at a tender age of 49 or something like that, 48. And I started attending church in Lincoln, and I was confirmed in 1985, which is a big year, which I'll go into later.
That sounds like John Wesley, in our experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also say, as an Episcopalian, you can be anything from a Unitarian to a Roman Catholic inside the Episcopal Church.
That's right. You can. You're pretty good at that. But I don't really feel myself trying to pull myself or it in any other direction. We have a priest that's pretty mainstream. He has a military air about him because he was a chaplain in Vietnam. So his hair is cut short, and he's extremely punctual. He doesn't bark at you for sermons. I didn't mean that, but he's got these positive aspects of the military character that are still there.
Do you want to go back into?
No, I was going to rather talk about a question. Okay, fine. Well, let's see. I don't know where I was here. Let's see.
You talked about you were repairing things in your father's garage, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Buying the engine lathe.
Yeah, buying the engine lathe, which we had up until a few years ago. So it cleaned down, so we decided this place is pretty, too much stuff and too much space, and a lot of it never used, so we had a big house cleaning when we consolidated our operations, and we got running on much less square foot per person, in fact much less square foot period, and without any troubles, perfectly comfortable. Nobody has to step over things that are what the heck was that? I don't know, it's been here since I've been here. Well, let's see. It was at this time we got a request for a scientific instrument that wasn't one shot. It was a fraction collector for liquid chromatography. This apparatus collects sequentially separated chemicals into test tubes from a chemical separator called a chromatographic column. This was written for non-chemists, of course. The fraction collector served a market niche I knew something about biological. Chemical laboratory instruments under the influence of my father. My father was a plant virus researcher. I talked about him in that respect earlier. His position dealt a lot in biochemistry. Nobody knew something about biochemical and plant research methodologies. Incidentally, ESCO still makes fraction collectors. It's over a $4,000 segment of our business. Every 5 years or so, we bring out another one.
Mm-hmm.
My father gave me a copy of the USDA's Agricultural Research Service Professional Staff Roster. Presto, I now had the makings of a mailing list. marketed, or marketed fraction placards by direct mail. It was easy to check off the job titles. It sounded like they had something to do with biochemical research. The Lincoln printer was church bulletins, printed them were not very good, but entirely adequate brochures for the product. And suddenly we had a shoestring manufacturing business going. The electronics in the product were crude, using government surplus tubes and generic metal box cases. As were the mechanicals, new test tubes were punched out of the test tube reels were punched out of sheet aluminum with a punch activated by a 3-pound sledgehammer to band. But the important point was in this particular niche, separation applications for biochemical research. Other companies produced no better products, produced products of no better caliber than ours. By looking at it this way, our little shoestring prototype garage and basement operation could compete because our competitors didn't know much more about what they were doing than we knew about what we were doing. And about this time, our first big trial hit. The Elgin Watch Company closed down, and Jake had to decide whether to take a gamble on ISCO being a full-time business for him or get a job which would probably involve moving out of town.
When was that?
That was in 1962. Mm-hmm. No. It was before we set up a permanent business, 1959.
Mm-hmm. What was the legal nature of the business?
We were a corporation. Incorporated under the laws of the state of Nebraska, of course. And the name of the company was Instrumentation Specialties Company, which reflected our business idea of taking on about anything in the instrument area. And later we changed the name of the initial ISCO. Mm-hmm. The original name was cumbrous and non-descriptive. The company was incorporated right at the start, I believe, in 58. And reincorporated in the early 60s because of some stock offering that we had, which we'll get to in a minute.
Was it initially just a straight partnership of the two of you, or how?
It was effectively a partnership. And it was, Jake and I each had 48% of the stock. My father had 2%, which gave me quasi-control, because my father wouldn't necessarily side with me. And for all practical purposes, it was a partnership. I don't think his 2% vote was ever invoked.
What was the other 2%?
49%, sorry.
Okay.
Arithmetic.
So it was literally just it was the direct mail, the responses to that for the fraction collector that shifted it.
Yeah, that moved us into this. I mean, started making fraction collectors for the universities here in Omaha, and then got into the mail order. Hard were enough cheaper. They weren't hard to sell by mail order. Mm. I think we could make them cheaper because we were had almost no overhead. Let's see, in 1959, that was when the Elgin Watch Company closed down. And we were starting to receive those orders by mail. And since Timex was the only successful U.S. watch company at the time, Jake decided to stay here at ISCO in Lincoln. I started looking for other products we could sell to the same market. The first one was the most obvious, an even cheaper version of our fraction collector. The next was an instrument for fractionating centrifuge density gradient tubes, the techniques which is used for rate of sedimentation, rate separation of macromolecules in an ultracentrifuge. This was followed by development work on UV light absorbance detectors, made separations either by liquid chromatography or by centrifuge density gradients. Incidentally, this this up to the current date we use a lot of phosphorescent devices cascaded together in a patented way for getting better narrower higher throughput and bit narrower bandwidth light filters than you don't get with interference filters. That's particularly the case in the early 60s. And this involves some chemistry, which is some that made me nervous. Making rare earth fluoride phosphorus. And that was one thing that I was always had trouble with in chemistry. I remember the hardest thing I ever had to do in chem laboratory was measure stuff out on a two-panel analytical balance. Because it, in order to measure it, you have to get it close, which is with the force of some little weights and stuff. But then you got to move a milligram writer on the top. And the milligram writer was essentially, the handle for it was essentially out of my reach.
Oh, I see.
And so I take one hand, pop the other hand up there, and lay my elbow on a pile of books and fiddle around, knock the milligram writer off the top, call for help and get the writer perched back on top of there. Well, that was bad, but even worse, I was very conscious of lab safety and my own limitations, and I remember once I had a hydrogen explosion blow up a thing and blew sulfuric acid all over my face, and I got the running a lab shower, really had a sink with a high shower on it for the purpose of putting my head on it and turn it on. So didn't suffer any damage, but when that coat came back from the cleaning, it came in a plastic bag and it was just a little shred. Anyway, this involved precipitating soluble rare earth salts, co-precipitating soluble rare earth salts with hydrofluoric acid, which was not my idea of any fun, and then heat treating. Well, heat treating is by nature hot, but I wasn't worried about that. It shall do with the force that's down in the crucible furnace. But, I hate the precipitation process. I pick up the bottle of this crap and put it in the tub, my hand would shake. I was glad when I was able, when I had other people here to do the actual physical manipulation. Chemistry. Just tell them what to do.
Because you were, I mean, everything was batch processing, as it were, or making individual orders.
This was making. I made up about enough phosphor for over 1,000 UV detectors, which we used up. I wasn't the one that personally made it the next time.
When did you first hire someone to help in Tokyo? What moment was it?
Help what?
In the beginnings of ISCO now, too. As an employee or?
Well, I had the two machinists, and being the designer, I was also the electronic assembler, that was another waste of my time. So next person I hired was an electronic technician who could assemble and test, disassemble and QC test instruments.
When you said you had the two machinists, what? And just go more slowly through the chronology of this. You yourself are doing this in the...
Well, it started out simultaneously, Jake working in his basement, me working in the garage.
Yeah.
With him doing the machine work, and I did everything else.
And the orders coming, how were the...
And he also was repairing microscopes.
And how were the first orders obtained? I mean, the first 20 orders, as it were.
Well, yeah. The very first orders were from people that we repair things for.
But how did they know that you existed?
You know, Jake went around and passed out business cards.
Mm-hmm. Around the university?
Around the University of Nebraska. Yeah.
So these were individual professors saying,
yeah,
can you fix this?
Yeah, and then we'd get a purchase order. And simultaneously with about getting the thing, they would take care of getting a purchase order. We were pretty naive about purchase orders, and we'll get that to that later. And before we moved into a purpose-built building, we hired a machinist to assist Jake.
How long after starting out did you, you know, realize, gee, there's more work here than I can do?
Yes. Not until we moved into this other building, and it was we'd been in there for 6 months or something like that. It was still being there. Probably the summer of 61.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired a fourth employee, kind of myself and Jake's employee, to do the assembly and testing. And I just kind of kept hiring people to take work off of me. Eventually hired a full-time bookkeeper finally, and I didn't have to interface with an external bookkeeper. I think that was in 64 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think we had maybe by 64 we had, I think, about 40 employees.
Mm-hmm. When did the fraction kind of collector come in?
Probably 1958, probably, you know, 6 months after we started repairing things.
And what else was going on in your life? You're still the impact of the polio. And,
well, I was back in school with that.
And this,
so I've got all this down here. I'll take that part.
Okay.
And what it meant to me. And at this time, talking about here, I was in school. I talked about school earlier, and this is concurrent with the school stuff. And we were a number of people. We got some competitors who also realized that the biochemical instrumentation was an underserved market area. At the same time, I was having fun with my master's research in the electro-optical properties of bentonite cells. By chance, I also learned how to make electrically tunable light filters, which unfortunately were not useful in spectrophotometers because of the way the color change went. But that was kind of an interesting thing. I learned a lot about electro-optical effects and asymmetrical particles in suspension.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered some things I never could explain in the time that I had available. I just reported them. Well, one of the things that was strange with him, to get a better insight into Benton, and I saw this required a lot of problems. Benton, it started with a sack full of bentonite, which is gorge mud. Mm-hmm. And then you try to get mud to disperse a bunch of particles through the particle size. It affects these electro-optical properties due to the viscous coupling to the liquid. And then also the charge on, I experimented with electrodialysis to try and remove charge, various other ions to try and add charge and stuff like this. And in order to get a better feeling for a simpler system, I worked with nitrobenzene, which is has a high electro-optical constant, and which involves a lot of higher voltages. But I had to make a 15 kilovolt pulse generator. And the other thing about it, depending on what type of electrodes I would use with metal, you get different patterns. And for instance, with chromium surfaced, I remember the chromium surfaced ones, you get an almost rainbow appearing effect. That is, the field between two parallel plates was not uniform. Mm-hmm. Even though there was a uniform, even though it was a pure solution. And it makes them really beautiful rainbow-like patterns where you go through zero transmission zeros at various wavelengths. And they would start out, and you increase the voltage, and you get a blue in the color on one electrode, mm-hmm. moving out. It's reminiscent, and it's baffling, I'm sure, to me, as people 100 years ago did with ion discharge tubes. Probably started going on a problem of research that I was convinced it was mechanical effect with ionic reactions and recombinations and stuff like that. And I developed a bunch of hypothetical solutions that they were in the form of differential equations that couldn't be solved manually. And I obviously didn't have access to a digital computer, which was kind of ironic at the time. But
well, anyway, that was
a PhD subject.
Yeah, it would have been a good PhD subject. And more interesting than the bentonite salt.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, another product of lime that started being in the garage shop area was plant growth chambers. We approached by the professor, even though it was a ground department, to make a small plant growth chamber, not much bigger than a large kitchen refrigerator, with precise humidity control, as well as the usual temperature control and solar simulation. Up until then, plant growth chambers did not have humidity controls. We built in one and thus added another item to our product line. Later, we developed a larger plant growth chamber, about as large as could be shipped without knocking it down. Both plant growth chambers were considerably more sophisticated than any other units available. We were aiming for the high end of the market and trying to build a unit that incorporated instrument expertise that other makers didn't have. We were successful, but this success was a mixed blessing. As a result, I did not consider ISCO to be limited to the separation science business, and this lack of focus prevented us from fully capitalizing on the so-called liquid chromatography revolution many years, 10 years later. One thing that does evolve from research on that area was the use of metal arc lights and mercury arc lights too, instead of fluorescent lights for plant growth. And I designed and built the world's first portable spectroradiometer to study this. And that also became a product. And I suppose if you ask any overage hippie right now, I'd tell you that what they smoke is probably grown under metal arc lights. At least that's what I understand from reading the newspaper. Okay. The metal arc lights give a very white sunlight-like light. Mm-hmm. And we never considered growing any of that stuff. I don't think anybody even knew where it was. But they were the first to grow plants in artificial environments with metal arc lights. Mm-hmm. In 1959, we were approached by a big one-of-a-kind job by a professor in the Department of Veterinary Science.